Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 9 a.m. Chairman's time. With me today is Senator Bishop, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Wilson, Senator Hoffman is at another meeting, and Senator Hoffman, I guess, is online. So, and we may be joined later by Senator Von Imhoff. If she joins us, she'll be online. They're off at other meetings. With that, today we have one order of business. We're going to have a presentation from Callan and Associates, which we do every year. We're going to talk about the permanent fund. They're the consultants to the permanent fund and other arenas around the state. So we'll have some discussions about that. So with us today online, we have Mr. Greg Allen and Steve Center, both from Callan Association. So whoever wants to lead the presentation, they can introduce themselves for the record, who they represent, take us through the presentation. We'll go one slide at a time, and then I'll cue you up when we're going to go to the next slide in case there's questions. We're also joined in the room by Ms. Angela Riddell, CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Callan and Associates to take us through their presentation.
All right. Thank you very much. My name is Greg Allen. I'm the CEO and Chief Research Officer at Callan. I've been at the firm for 33 years, and a goodly portion of that, I've worked with the Alaska Permanent Fund in one way, shape, or form. I'm currently one of the co-consultants on the account with Steve Center, who's joining me for this presentation. We'll be talking a little bit about the capital markets, about our forward-looking outlook for the fund, how it's done, and we'll also be addressing the Alaska retirement portfolio as well at the end of the presentation. So if we could bring up the presentation itself, and if there are any questions while we're doing that, I'd be happy to answer those in advance.
We have an hour and a half on today, and we've got 30-some slides, so we're going to get through this today. So if we start slowing down, I'll have to speed you boys up, and I'll watch the clock. So go ahead and continue.
All right, we'll try to keep you on time. Can we? Do you guys see the presentation? I can't tell from my angle here.
Yes. So we'll go to slide two.
Slide two, please, which has the outline on it.
Okay, let's go to slide three where we get some substance here.
All right, slide three then. So the first part of our presentation, every year, Callan conducts a process where we come up with a 10-year forecast for the various capital markets, and then we take a look at what that means for our clients' portfolios. So I'm going to get a little bit of a description of how that works. These are 10-year projections, so they're not designed to help you decide what to do with your money next week or the next year. They're really meant for long-term strategic planning. They take into account the long-term relationships between stocks and bonds and real estate and hedge funds and private equity and all the asset classes that are employed by the Alaska Permanent Fund in their diversified portfolio. They're generally representative of consensus outlooks, so we spend a lot of time looking at what the central banks are saying, economists, asset managers, consultants. That's an integral part of the process. We are not outliers. The numbers tend to change slowly. They're used, for those that aren't familiar with Callan, we work with a lot of large funds. We have about $2 trillion in client assets, many of whom use these expectations to do their planning and their portfolio construction. So they don't tend to change a lot from year to year, but they do change based on what happens in each year. There are three numbers that we have to come up with each asset class that we're projecting. So using stocks as an example, we have to come up with the expected return, the annualized return. We come up with another number called the standard deviation, which is how volatile the return is going to be, the range if you will, of returns that are possible. And then the correlation, which is a measure of how stocks interact with the other asset classes. A high correlation means that that stocks behave very similarly to that asset class. A low correlation means that they might actually go in the opposite direction of each other in terms of their returns. So we develop all of these numbers for all of the various asset classes employed by the Alaska Permanent Fund and our other clients. We execute this process with a team of economists, actuaries, CFAs, MBAs. We all get together and argue. I've been involved in it. I was hired at Cowen in 1988, actually, to improve this process, and I've basically been involved with it ever since. We've used this with the Permanent Fund over, I believe, almost that entire time since you've been our client, or they have been our client for that entire period. It's a battle-proven process. These numbers get challenged by hundreds of different institutions with really smart people on investment committees and boards, as well as staff, and they hold up pretty well. I'm not arguing that they're always exactly right, but I will argue that they're reasonable and they create reasonable expectations. So I'll pause there and ask if there are any questions regarding the capital market projections.
Okay, we're going to keep going and pick up the pace. We do this every year, some of us, for decades. We've got the understanding.
Okay. So, all right. Then we'll go to slide 4. This is just designed to show you the 10-year return, the blue line, the trailing 10-year return on stocks, S&P 500. And you can see that it's been as high as 20%, and it's been as low as in the negative. So the last time we had a negative 10-year return was back in 08. 1045 is what it's averaged. So the average 10-year return over the last 100 years has been 10.45 on the S&P 500. Our outlook is 6.5. So I just want to let folks know that we're basically forecasting that the next 10 years is going to be in the bottom third of what we've observed in the past, and it's going to be about 400 basis points behind. Now, that's the midpoint. We have a big range around that, but that's what we're looking at. We can flip to the next slide.
Okay.
Slide 5. That's simply designed to show that when you go to 30 years, the volatility calms down quite a bit with equities. And the only point of this slide is that if you have a long time horizon, you can afford to take more equity risk because you really don't care about those dips like we had at the beginning of 2020, for example. You know, you get a very tight range when you go out to 30 years with stocks. So that's really the point of this slide. The worst 30-year period we've ever seen in the last 100 years, stocks returned 8.5, which would be pretty good if we got that in over the next 30 years. We'll go to slide 6. I included this slide. This is a histogram that basically shows each year and where the return for that year on stocks resided. And the reason I put this slide out here is I just want to point out that we've had a pretty good run lately. If you look at 2020, up 18.4. That's a year with a pandemic, by the way. 2016 up 12, 2014 up 13.7, 2012 up 16. 2019 up 31.5, 2013 up 32.4. These are the returns that we've experienced for the last 10 years in the stock market. We only had one down year, which was 2018. So, you know, as a result, I think in the Permanent Fund and the Retirement Management Board's portfolio, you're seeing an all-time level of healthiness in terms of the assets, in terms of the earnings reserve, et cetera. So I just want to make sure everybody understands that. So let's flip to the next slide, slide 7. This is just designed to help you sort of understand how unprecedented the pandemic market response was. We basically went into bear market territory over the course of 16 days. That's the orange line there. We contrast that with the global financial crisis and the tech bubble, which, you know, collected, which took, you know, 361 days to get to the bottom for the tech bubble. I mean, for the global financial crisis, and 521 days to get to the bottom for the tech bubble. So this was an unprecedentedly sharp decline and an unprecedentedly sharp response. Just to put that in perspective, off the bottom, I believe small cap stocks, for example, are up over 100%. So really, it was a quick snapback. And, you know, obviously that benefited the permanent fund portfolio as well as the retirement management board. If we flip to slide 8, this is just designed to show you equity valuations. This is a measure of their price relative to their forward-looking earnings. And the point of this graph is just to show you that the current valuations are well above one standard deviation relative to the long-term average. Generally, when you start a period with high valuations like this, the returns are lower. And that's a big reason why we're looking at a 6.5% return on stocks as opposed to a 10.5% return. All right, flip to slide 9. This is the bond market. This is that same 10-year historical return on the bond market. You can see that it's a lot less volatile. It was a big cyclical change. The reason I put this up is that the average return, 10-year return on bonds, has been 5.5. That green line is what we're projecting, which is 175. And again, almost a 4% difference there. And note that there have been very few 10-year periods where bonds have returned less than what we're projecting for bonds. So I think that's a really important point. In the last 100 years, we're saying that, you know, the next 10 years are going to be about the worst we've ever seen for bonds. Still positive, but as low as we've seen. The reason we're fairly confident about bonds projections is shown on slide 10. There's a very tight relationship between the yield to maturity on the bond index and the return on that bond index over the next 10 years. In this chart, we've got the yield at a given point in time, and then we contrast that with the return over the ensuing 10 years, and you get a pretty tight line here. In finance, there are very few things that you can be certain about, but one of them is bond returns. Now, if we get sharply rising interest rates, it's going to be lower than the current yield, realistically. We do have, in our projections, gradually rising interest rates built in, and you know, that gets us to about a 1.75% return at the median. So it's going to be tough to make money on bonds over the next 10 years. If we flip to slide 11, the only reason I included this, this is the long-term relationship between stocks and bonds. So the green line is the stock return minus the bond return. And it's been on average about 5%. So stocks have generally returned 5% more than bonds. And if you look at our capital market projections, that's roughly what we're projecting is, you know, stocks at 6.5, bonds at 175. Very few periods, 10-year periods, where stocks have outperformed bonds, but in those periods, or bonds have outperformed stocks, pardon me, but in those periods where bonds outperform stocks, you really wanted to have bonds. So it's still a good idea to have bonds in your portfolio, even if the return projections aren't great.
Okay, if you could just pause there for a second. On just for the committee members, this Ibbotson and Associates, that's what the data came from. We have those books in the office. If you want to have them for a while and look through them with the different asset classes and historic returns and volatility and all that, goes into a much deeper detail. In fact, there's numerous back copies. They come out every year, and they cover different things, so the committee members are certainly welcome to them. Senator Wilikowski, then Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Read a few articles where people have suggested that things have changed significantly because the federal banks have been injecting so much money into the system. Have we ever seen a period of time where federal banks have put so much money into the system and with such low interest rates? And do you think that, are you at all concerned that this is going to impact your projections?
Thank you for that question. That is something that we've definitely taken into account in our projections. And in fact, I think if you look at our projections, they're consistent with central banks and others who have also taken that into account. There's a lot of talk right now in the press about inflation, about this being, creating an inflationary environment. I chuckle at that because we've actually lowered our inflation expectation by 25 basis points this year. It's very difficult to find economists out there or banks that are calling for higher inflation, even in spite of this injection of massive liquidity into the system. I guess I would point to only one example that we've seen of this kind of central bank intervention where we have some history, and that's Japan. Japan went through sort of coming into the 80s and 90s, a period where interest rates became very low due to the central bank intervention. A lot of capital flooding into their capital markets from central bank intervention over the ensuing 10, 15 years. And they didn't have inflation. In fact, they had deflation. So I think there's a good reason to be concerned about the amount of liquidity that's coming in. We're certainly seeing signs of the impact of that. Recent IPO activity is unprecedented. So I think you are going to see pockets of exuberance and ultimately potential small bubbles, but we do not believe that fundamentally at this point it's inflationary. There are a lot of opposing forces. A good chunk of the labor force is still out of work as a result of the pandemic. So at this point, we don't have a great concern about inflation or rapidly rising bond yields.
General Rilakowski, a follow-up?
Yeah, I mean, at some point, all this money is going to have to be paid back. And how are the experts, I guess, suggesting that all this money will be paid back? And when will it happen, and what will be the impacts on the markets?
I think the that's a really good question, is how will it be paid back? I think the general assumption is that as the economy recovers, there'll be an ability to increase taxes. You know, I think people are forecasting that that's coming, and that will definitely counter the inflationary trend. You've got the Democrats in charge of all three branches of the federal government, which makes it conducive to increasing taxes. So, you know, at least that's one element that is out there countervailing this. We have seen periods where we have had bull markets, extended bull markets, result in significant increases in tax revenue. So that's one avenue for paying it back. But at some point, there's going to have to be some fiscal restraint as well. And so I guess we're hoping that once we get through this next round of stimulus, you know, people in those positions start to inject some discipline into the system. I would note that a lot of the state governments are really suffering at this point and, you know, are in need of some of the stimulus as well to, you know, shore up their systems, because they've had to pay out a lot in unemployment, and they've also suffered declines in tax revenue. But yeah, I think you raise a good question. You know, when are we going to pay this back, or are we just going to pass it on to our to the next generation?
I think the last sentence is probably the answer to the question. Senator Bishop.
I'll pass.
Pass. Okay, unfortunately, I think that's what might be coming. So let's go on then to slide 12.
All right, slide 12. This is the second dimension of our capital market projections. This is risk. These are the trailing 10-year standard deviations for some of the asset classes that are employed by the Alaska Permanent Fund and the Retirement Board. And the point of this is just to show two things. One, these risk relationships are fairly stable, at least relative to each other. So emerging markets has always had the highest risk. You know, bonds and real estate have always had the lowest risk. The red line in there shows the trailing volatility of the permanent fund, and you can see that it's, you know, somewhere between stocks and bonds. So that's the benefit of diversification. And the only other point I want to make from this slide is, if you look at starting in about 2018, the 10-year trailing risk has really come down quite a bit for all these asset classes. So in addition to enjoying pretty high returns, we've enjoyed a period of relatively stable markets. So this is this has been a, you know, about as good a set of markets as we could ever expect over the last 10 years, both from a risk and return standpoint. Flipping to slide 13.
We could stop for a second.
Yep.
Stop on 12. Help me with the real estate, because they don't have a market quite like bonds or equities, and how you gauge the volatility or the standard deviation here of real estate. You do it with appraisals or actual sales of property, or how do they derive that underlying numeric?
Yeah, that's a great question, because you're absolutely right. Real estate does not trade on a daily basis, and so it's not subject to the kind of volatility that's created by people's opinions changing all at the same time. So real estate, this is the real estate index, and the returns on the real estate index are driven by essentially the income that is produced, the rental income, and then appraisals, which come, you know, once a year for most properties. Although that's increasing more often to once a quarter, but even if it's once a quarter, the price doesn't change very fast. So when we look at this standard deviation, you know, this is the standard deviation that the permanent fund actually felt in their real estate portfolio or close to it. But when we do projections for real estate, we actually increase the standard deviation in our projections to reflect the economic risk in real estate, which I think you're starting to see right now. I mean, this has been a good example. This last year, there's been no transactions. And when there are no transactions, the appraisers are very hesitant to change the appraisal price because they don't have comps. So real estate has actually held up pretty well in spite of the fact that a lot of malls have seen, you know, drop-offs of, you know, 90% in terms of their traffic, and they're starting to shutter businesses that can't survive. So we are going to see, in all likelihood, and we're already starting to see the signs, particularly in the retail market, of declines in real estate prices. We think we're going to see declines in rental income for office space as people get back to work. I think there's going to be a different view about how many people have to be in the office every day, and that will inevitably have an impact on vacancy rates, in particularly in large cities. So parts of the real estate market are going to suffer, but on the other hand, there are other parts of the real estate market that are actually doing really well. Industrial, you know, these suburban office complexes, distribution centers, or properties where you can place those for e-commerce. So on balance, it's not a disaster, but there are definitely pockets of the real estate market. And we won't see that in terms of the volatility until those appraisals pick that up.
And then maybe touch on, if you could, private equity. That's also something that's a little different animal. How do you?
Yep, private equity. You know, we think it has significantly more risk than the public equities market. One of those risks in particular being bad implementation. I would comment that the permanent fund in particular has one of the best private equity portfolios that across our client base. And that's reflected in the returns it's generated over the last 3 or 4 years. But we have, you know, there's a wide dispersion of results in private equity. Private equity is also valuation driven. You know, when a company goes public, you know, then it gets written up. They try to do a decent job of reflecting what happens in the markets, but private equity pricing is reported with at least a 1 quarter lag. And so as an example, I would take the fourth quarter of 2018. The equity markets went down in that quarter fairly significantly, but by January they had recovered in 2019. A lot of private equity portfolio managers didn't even bother to write their portfolios down for that fourth quarter because they already knew they were back to where they were. So private equity observed volatility masks the actual volatility underneath the hood. If they'd had to go out and sell their companies at the end of 2018, you would have seen a much greater drop in the price than what's reflected in the private equity return.
Okay, go on then to correlations, please.
All right. So the next slide is correlations. The point of this is just to show that those are also relatively stable in terms of their relationships, and then also to show that the permanent fund, and this would be true of the RMB portfolio as well, has a very high correlation to the equity market. So this is basically the trailing 10-year correlation with the U.S. equity market. And while the permanent fund employs everything from infrastructure to real estate to bonds to private equity, at the end of the day, what drives the volatility of the permanent fund is the equity markets. And so if we see an equity downdraft, in spite of all the diversifying things that are in there, the permanent fund is going to go down. And if the markets go up, the permanent fund is going to go up. So it's impossible to remove equity risk from a long-term investment portfolio. It is the single most important driver of risk. I think the permanent funds and RMB have done a great job of finding diversifying strategies that on the margin reduce risk, But at the end of the day, as go the equity markets, so goes the permanent fund.
So do these correlations, do they deviate from their normal practices in significant downdrafts or up movements? Do the correlations then have a tendency of coming together?
Yeah, so I think if you look at 2008, it's a good example, or, you know, if you just look at real estate, and again, the real estate correlation masks the actual underlying risk of real estate. So when we project correlations between real estate and equities, our projections are higher than this light blue line that's on here. But in 08, we did see, in 09, which was a real estate-driven financial crisis, we did see real estate prices drop significantly at the same time as equities were down. And so that you see that 10-year correlation pop up for that short period of time where that was in the window. So that's true for all asset classes that involve risk. They can have low correlations during relatively stable periods. But when everybody's afraid and they're dumping risk, you know, risk assets are going to go down, and that increases their correlation to equities.
So when the tide goes out, all boats go down.
Yeah.
You can understand.
Hopefully you have your swim trunks on.
Yeah. We'll go on then to slide 14.
So slide 14, this is our diversification chart. It's called the periodic table of investment returns. What we do here is simply for each calendar year, we stack up the asset classes from the highest returning at the top to the lowest returning at the bottom. And this is just a design to show you that the reason you diversify is that there's not a single asset class that's on top every single year. So you want to have a little bit of all of them. The red squares represent the permanent fund, which definitely has a little bit of all of them. And as you can see, it's generally in the middle, which is what you'd expect from a diversified portfolio. It's never going to be in the top because there are components of it that are driving its return that are always going to do better than it as a whole. Another point I would make here is this has been a pretty bad period for non-U.S. equity. A big part of that has been the strong dollar. When the dollar goes up, the value of your non-U.S. investments goes down. But this has also been a really strong period for U.S. equities relative to non-U.S. equities. So when you have a global portfolio like the permanent fund, you've got a little bit of both. And so their equity portfolio has not kept up with the U.S. equity market. And I would say that's true of all of our clients.
Okay, next slide.
All right, on slide 15, all I did here was look at the same chart over 10-year periods, ended in each of these years. And this just demonstrates that if you have a long time horizon, the riskier asset classes generally come out on top. And if I extended this to 20 or 30 years, it would be even more true. But private equity, particularly for these periods, has been, you know, one of the top performing asset classes.
Okay. Next slide.
All right. So in terms of our capital market projections, I talked about a fair amount of this. We think GDP growth in the U.S. is 2 to 2.5%, lower for the developed ex-U.S. markets and higher for the emerging markets. We've lowered our inflation expectation, and this has been a challenging. It's tough when you lower your expectation and then the media all of a sudden gets really excited about inflation. So I've had some interesting conversations about this. We were pretty comfortable, though, at the end of last year, lowering it. Our global equity projection for the permanent fund has come down by about 50 basis points relative to last year. Fixed income has come down by about 85 basis points, and that's just because of the massive decline in rates that we saw over the course of the year. And then we've gradually ratcheted down our expectations for everything else. So private equity came down, private real estate came down, infrastructure came down. So across the board, we've lowered our return expectations. Our risk expectations and correlation expectations have remained largely the same. So the net impact of that is that the return on the permanent fund that we're projecting has come down. I let you look at slide 17 at your leisure. It has all of the individual asset classes that we have to come up with projections for. And so you can see how they kind of all play out relative to each other, but I don't have any significant comments on that slide. If we go to slide 18, I think this is just a little history lesson, and it's actually reflective, I think, of the permanent fund structure as well. I've been doing capital market projections since 1988. If you had asked me to develop a portfolio to generate a 7% return in 1988, 1991, I should say. These are Cowen's forward-looking projections at the time. What would you need to do to generate a 7% return? In 91, you could have had a portfolio that was 98% cash and 2% bonds. Interest rates were very high relative to now at that point, and cash was actually yielding close to 7%. In 2006, if you went through the same exercise, you could have a portfolio that was almost 60% bonds, or a little over 60%, and the rest of it made up of, you know, sort of a generic stock portfolio. And we would have forecasted a 7% return, and again, a risk of 6.7%, so volatility less than return. Fast forward to 2021, looking at our capital market projections, if you wanted to generate 7%, you basically could have 3% in bonds, and all the rest had to be in risk-seeking assets, with real estate being the lowest volatility. You have to have a 17% private equity allocation, and then the rest of it in global equities. So the point of this is simply to illustrate that as yields have come down in the bond market, the return on everything else has come down, and you've had to have an increasingly risky and complex portfolio in order to generate the same rate of return as you did in the past. All right, moving on to the next slide. Actually, flip to slide 20, so there's a little tab slide in there. This is where the rubber hits the road. We take the permanent fund portfolio. We run it through all those capital market projections, standard deviations, correlations. Our expectation for the next 10 years for the return is 6.2%, and that's sitting on an inflation expectation of 2%, which gets you to an expected real return of 4.2%. Now, that's the midpoint. We obviously have a range around that, standard deviation, the annual standard deviation being 13.5%. The net of that is we believe there's about a 45% chance that you'll hit a 5% real and a 55% chance that you will return less than a 5% real in the permanent fund portfolio. I'll stop to see if there are any questions on that.
Yeah, we'll be here a little bit, I think, on this one.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. How would you compare the riskiness of the permanent fund's investment posture to other sovereign wealth funds around the world?
I'd probably put it in the middle. You know, I think the permanent fund has a highly diversified portfolio. I would commend them that they've not overreached for return, like some. They have, you know, methodically moved the portfolio into private markets investments. Private equity at 16%, real estate at 8%, private infrastructure and credit at 9%, and then we'd actually consider that absolute return category to be quasi-illiquid as well. So when you add all those up, you get about almost 40% in what we consider illiquid assets, and I'd say that's in the middle for sovereign wealth funds. I think we see them as high as 60%, and as low as maybe 30%. But that's kind of industry best practices at this point. These sovereign wealth funds generally have very long time horizons, and so they don't have to worry about selling stuff to make their payments. And so they can afford to take what we call illiquidity risk. But that's one of the risks that's in the permanent fund. All those assets in those buckets cannot be immediately disposed of without taking a significant haircut relative to their valuations. The rest of the risk in the portfolio is sort of straight up equity risk. You can see the global equities at 38%, but I would say you still have a pretty good chunk of fixed income. I'd say this is certainly relative to foundations and endowments. This is actually a very high level of fixed income. We see endowments as low as 5%. So in our view, at least, this is not the time to stretch for return because with the markets as highly valued as they are, you're not getting paid very much for taking additional risk. So in our view, at least, we believe the permanent fund to be in a good spot in terms of the level of risk that they're taking relative to their peers.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, you often hear about the bond to stock ratio is 50-50 or 60-40, and I guess this is much more complex than that, but it seems to me like this is probably more like a 75-25 kind of split. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'd say that That's pretty much exact. We actually did an analysis of the level of risk implied by this portfolio translated into a simple stock and bond mix, and that's what we came out with is 75-25.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If this earnings reserve was collapsed and put into the corpus of the fund, would that change the investment suggestions to the permanent fund board going forward?
So maybe I can ask for a clarification on that question. So are you suggesting that we do away with the earnings reserve and go to a pure POMV model, or are you suggesting you appropriate the entire earnings reserve into principal?
Collapse the earnings reserve account, do away with it, constitutional amendment, put it inside the corpus and do the POMV off of the total corpus.
Okay.
Would that change your investment model outlook for the next 10 years?
I would say that generally that would allow for the permanent fund to take more illiquidity risk and increase their private markets exposure, which on the margin should help. One of the concerns that we have with the earnings reserve account model is that if we have a significant period of negative equity markets, combined with now the bigger draw on the earnings reserve, we could get to a point where the earnings reserve is depleted to the point where we wouldn't be able to make the draw on the one hand. And when you have to make that draw in those types of markets, the only place you can go to fund that draw is your equities. So while that market is down, you're selling equities because they're liquid. You can't go to your private markets portfolio because that's probably the worst time to sell those assets. And so the more you have in private markets, the sooner you hit that limit where you don't have anything left. So you have to keep a fair amount of liquidity given the size of the draw. In our view, if you could do away with the ERA, that would take a significant risk off the table of not being able to make the draw because of some kind of what I consider to be kind of an artificial accounting metric. But at some level, given that you're doing 5% of the trailing five out of the last 6 years POMV, we think that's a reasonable formula. That should result in something around 4 to 4.5% in any given year being pulled out. But you still have to maintain some liquidity for those down markets, even if you got rid of the ERA. So long-winded way of saying I think you'd be better off without the ERA, but it doesn't completely change the picture from an investment standpoint.
Thank you.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about one of your comments there. There's a couple issues, but we'll start with the draw rate. You'd mentioned that a draw rate of 4 to 4.5%. You've mentioned a five-year trailing or five-year average of the six-year trailing, which appears to be reasonable. How reasonable is that draw rate at 4 to 4.5% versus 5% or 8.5% or 7% or some other number?
Yeah. I think that the current formula with it at 5, I think it temporarily might be 5.25, but when it gets to 5, we think of that as a sustainable level, and it's consistent with best practices across all the endowments that we work with. It's very common to have a draw formula that results in, on average, something around 4 to 4.5% coming out of the fund. When you start to get above that, I think the result over long periods of time will be that you will erode the purchasing power of the corpus. The POMV formula, if it's straight up, does allow you to dip into the corpus at times, but there are also times where it restricts you from spending more than you should, and you can build the corpus. So we believe a 4% rate is consistent with maintaining the principal, the purchasing power of the principal, the real value of the principal. We don't think that at 4 to 4.5%, you're going to grow it. A lot of the endowments we work with, you know, they're schools and they do get donations, and so that's really their growth engine. You know, the permanent fund, I think, you know, everyone realizes that the oil revenue has become so small relative to the size of the fund that it's not going to result in material growth. So a long way of saying we think the current formula, taking the ERA out of it, is sustainable, but it's not going to result in the growth of the purchasing power. It's just going to allow you to maintain it on average over time.
And just a point of clarity, you mentioned 4%. Are you referring to 4% of the annual value or the trailing average? Because there's a difference in them. So you can help the committee understand a little more precisely what they're looking at?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for asking me to clarify that. So the current formula is 5% of the average market value. And you look back 6 years and you take the first 5 years, take the market value in each of those years, take the average and multiply that by 5%. Given that we have an expectation that the permanent fund is growing over time on average by about 6.5%, and you're taking an average of market values from the past when presumably on average they're smaller, it doesn't result in you spending 5% of the current market value, although there will be periods where that's true. But on average, it results in you spending less than that. And so my estimate is it's somewhere in the 4.2, 4.3% range of current market value that you'll be spending every year. So again, we believe that, you know, there's a 50% chance, even with these kind of dire 10-year projections, that you can earn 4.2% real. So if you're only pulling out 4.2% and you're earning 4.2% real, then your principal stays the same on a mark, on a real or inflation-adjusted basis.
So if you could help the committee, I don't know, maybe it's a permanent fund, we'll have to get them to bring it back, but I'd like to see a little standard deviation graph on it, on the returns here, with a normal distribution, unless you have a skewed distribution you work with, and a bugle chart on ending values.
Okay.
Sometimes the risk component is more easily grasped looking at a bugle chart because it's in dollars.
Yep.
Going forward, and it broadens out, as we know, as time advances. I think that would be helpful. And then on the return expectations here for the next 10 years, we are at 5%. Payout now of the percent of market value, but it appears that over the next 10 years we might be, well, it appears to be a little over the stretching point from these projections, if your projections hold true, which we all recognize are projections.
Yeah.
So at what point do these projections come down, and our payout, if it stays static at 5%, that the committee should start taking notice to have the discussion of lowering that payout to preserve the purchasing power going forward for future generations?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously got political ramifications, which I'm not familiar with, but we've been on record, I think, in board meetings as suggesting that you might want to move to 4.5% as soon as now, as opposed to waiting until it's too late. I think that 4.5% is more sustainable. And one of the things we've observed that I think is an important thing to keep in mind, we work with a lot of big government pension plans, and most of them have gone through a very painful process of lowering their return expectations, but they do it slowly and they do it sort of reluctantly. Because what it results in is that the state has to kick in more contributions every time they lower their return expectations. And so in a lot of cases where the state's under a lot of pressure, they don't do that, and then they go to the investment staff and they put pressure on the investment staff to take more risk. And so there is a kind of a perverse relationship between, you know, having too high of a draw and putting pressure on your investment staff or your board of the permanent fund to take more risk to meet that draw. And at this point in the cycle, I believe that if you're taking more risk, you're not getting paid very much for it. And you'd be better off being conservative in your draw than asking for somebody to try to stretch for a higher return. So we always like to see, it's painful in the short run, but we do like to see our pension clients and others have realistic expectations about return that allow them to be a little bit more conservative. Because I can tell you in 2008 or 2002, the folks that were out there on the risk spectrum, and we saw it in a lot of different ways come home to roost, they don't realize how much risk they're taking, or they don't realize how much risk their investment staff is taking until they actually feel what that means. And, you know, the permanent fund has lived through those types of periods, but those were periods back when it just resulted in a smaller dividend. It didn't have repercussions for the government. So, you know, the good thing about this POMV model, as long as it doesn't run into the ERA, is that you know in advance how much you're going to get paid. You know a year in advance because of that five of the last six. And also, a five-year moving average doesn't change that fast. So I think that it's a good model for resulting in a predictable draw and allows you to budget properly. But, you know, we think that it's really kind of it is high, and it's right now there's only a 45% chance of making it over the next 10 years. And the immediate reaction when someone sees that is, hey, you know, maybe we should put some more private equity in the portfolio or take some of those bonds out because they have low yields anyway. And, you know, I think that can be dangerous.
We have a question from Senator.
I pass.
You pass, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned before about some of the advantages of going to a POMV, and I'm just curious if you think the annualized return would increase somewhat, I guess allowing you to take a little bit more risk if you were to go to a POMV.
Again, I think that would be typically when we talk about the expected return on a portfolio, it's in the context of what is the objective. And, you know, I do think a POMV takes risk off the table for the state. The ERA is basically like a cliff hanging out there. The POMV model in its pure form results in very smoothed spending. And right now you're basically operating with a hybrid, which is a POMV, unless the ERA gets in the way. So that's really kind of a different risk. I'm not sure that it gets reflected in the way that the portfolio is invested. You know, on the margin, I would say I would want a little more liquidity around with the ERA. I would also point out that the ERA creates some interesting, potentially conflicting objectives. I know the investment staff doesn't even look at it this way, but there could be a point in time where there's not enough in the ERA, but you've got a bunch of unrealized gains in your equity portfolio. And if you wanted to make the draw, you could realize those gains, you know, sell the stocks, realize the gains, pump the ERA up and make the draw. And that would be inconsistent with kind of generating the highest total return, but it would be consistent with maintaining the draw. And it would be completely an artificial reaction to the fact that you've got this, you know, accounting construct driving the draw. So I do think the ERA introduces some potential strange incentives that are counterproductive. I think it introduces the potential of more volatility in the draw, particularly in down markets. I would say that you are in a good position right now because you've got a giant or, you know, a great healthy ERA. And you also have really high market value to cost, which means you've got a bunch of unrealized gains that haven't even hit the ERA that are sitting in the portfolio right now. So you're in about as healthy a position as you can expect to be over the next 20 years in terms of hitting that cliff. And, you know, it might not be a bad time to think about getting rid of it. My prediction is if it ever comes into play, there's going to be a rush to have a constitutional amendment to solve the problem. But that's me from the lower 48, and I don't really know what I'm talking about on that, so I'll stop there.
Yeah, and if you don't feel comfortable answering, I'm because there is a discussion going on. It has been going on for years. I think it is heightening about going to a constitutional POMV. And as we do that, there is a discussion of, well, what's the draw? And you're saying, I heard you say 4.5%. Sounds like you want 2% above, you want to factor in 2% above inflation. So if we're at 6.2% with the ERA model, it seems to me that you're taking liquidity off the table. You're able to invest that. You're increasing your returns somewhat. I mean, how much are we increasing the returns if we go to a POMV from 6.2? Is it 6.3? Is it 6.5? Is it 7? Do you have any sense?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I actually want to be clear that when we've been talking about 4%, that's 4 or 4.5. That's 4.5 above inflation. So that, you know, again, that's the draw in excess of inflation. Let me rephrase that. Sorry. We are talking about a 4.5% draw. So you're right. I'm sorry. 2.5% above inflation. And then the rest of it's to preserve the principal. So this is something that I think people struggle with. When you're dealing with a big, complex, diversified asset class portfolio like the permanent fund employees, there's not 50 or 80 or 100 basis points out there to get. So when we're talking about, you know, freeing up a little more liquidity and moving another 5% into private equity, our expectation is that might increase the long run return by maybe 10, 15 basis points. But that's really what we're talking about. There is no silver bullet out there where you're going to get an extra percent. I think we're hopeful that through good implementation. So one thing that isn't taken into account in our projections is what we call alpha, or the excess return created by beating the benchmarks. The permanent fund has been able to generate fairly consistent positive alpha over time. But again, when you talk to money managers, they'll come and talk to you and say they can get 3% alpha or 4% alpha. You know, we see the best institutions in the world are able to generate maybe 35 to 50 basis points of alpha. And that's really the range that we've seen with the permanent fund over time. So there's a little bit of a cushion built into our projections because we assume a zero alpha. And we think that this is a really well-run program, and we think that the permanent fund can probably beat those projections. And that is one way of making up that difference between your current draw and what we think is in the median sustainable. But I don't want anybody to get the impression that we believe, at least, that by switching to a POMV, you're going to be able to get another percent return. I think the change will be on the margin. I think the main benefit of switching to a pure POMV and getting rid of the ERA is that it takes away that cliff on spending. And I think, you know, stable spending has become much a bigger priority for the permanent fund than it was under the dividend model.
Okay, so you're, just to be clear, your spending, as you're talking about the outflow or payment of from the permanent fund to the state treasury, the general fund, not government spending, just to be clear.
Yes, exactly.
So yesterday we had a presentation going over the fiscal position of the state over the last, since 2015, frankly. We also saw several models when we looked forward that evaporated the ERA. Didn't reduce it, but eliminated it by 2028, 2030, or significantly crippled it thereafter. So I want you to talk a little bit about what size of the ERA you feel would be prudent with this added risk level we have with having an earnings reserve embedded into the endowment model that we have, and without the political twist to it, just the pure, you know, portfolio management twist, because we'll take care of the political side.
All right. Yeah. First off, I don't think you can do anything to control the ERA and its size. So I don't think there's anything from an investment. Well, the only thing you can do is not appropriate.
Let me rephrase that question to make it clear. Okay, when I'm talking about the size of the ERA, I'm talking about the multiple of against the draw.
Yeah.
You have 4 times cash position, 3 times, 10 times, 1 time, no time.
Yeah, so the smaller it is, the more risk that you're going to not be able to make the draw in a down market. 4 times is healthy. We've modeled it at its current size, and you know, basically the only thing we can do is we can put a probability around it running out of money at some point in the next 10 years, and we've done that, and we can present that again if you are interested in that. But it sounds like you've already got a model that's done that. But I don't, if you say to the, you know, your stakeholders, you know, we need to maintain a ERA that's 4 times the draw and the markets go down, there's nothing you can do. It won't stay 4 times the draw, right? So it's not something you can control. I think that if you say that it's 4 times the draw and it gets to 5 times the draw, I think there's going to be the temptation to take money out of the ERA and put it into the corpus, you know, as a kind of fiscally conservative measure. Anything you take out of the ERA increases the risk of the ERA getting too low to support the draw. So there's not, it's not as if there's an actual number that I can point to that's right. I'd point to the higher the better. In terms of keeping the ERA healthy. I don't know if I've answered your question, but.
Unfortunately, it's kind of a difficult one because it gets mixed in with politics. And clearly when you have an ERA sitting at $12 billion or some number in there, a lot of people look at it as just a big cash cow to go slaughter and spend. So, you know, we have the challenge here at the table when we factor in the added risk level we have when we have the ERA component embedded in this endowment, and to ensure that the ERA is at a is not exposed to ad hoc draws that then puts the permanent fund in a position where they have to restructure their asset class or change their risk levels and so on and so forth, particularly in a arena over the next decade where you're showing here that the returns are already lower. And our draw rate is already higher. So,
I would point to the. So I've been modeling the ERAs since the mid 90s for the permanent fund, and at one point I appeared in front of this same group. Many of you might even have been there, but this was about 97 or 98, and they had done an ad hoc inflation proofing appropriation back to the principal and basically taking the ERA down to zero. And I made the case with my model that there was a 25% chance that the dividend would go to zero in the next year or two. So, you know, again, I think that at that time, the legislature was being, in their mind, conservative, kind of taking that $100 million off the table so it wouldn't get spent. And again, the consequences were only that we weren't going to pay a dividend, although I think that would have made a lot of people in Alaska mad. Now, luckily, we had like 98, 99, and, you know, the ERA got healthy again, and we never really hit a point where it was gone. But I can tell you, starting with zero in the ERA, you're going to have a really high probability that you won't be able to make the draw. Particularly with the draw being the size it is now, which is like 3 or 4 times what the draw was under the dividend.
Yeah, so I wasn't referring to taking it to zero. Clearly, there's an interest in drawing precipitously above 5%. In fact, somewhere around 8 to 8.5, depending on whenever you want to pick the market value of the permanent fund, 70 billion, 75 billion, whatever. So it's somewhere around 8% this year, like within the next 60 days. So it does have our attention. And then the concern is, what's the following year? You know, do we face another, you know, precipitous draw rate? And then, therefore, put the state in a position where it has difficulty with its planned 5% draw and or start putting panic in the boardroom of the permanent fund, so they have to respond to the erratic appropriation requests coming out of the legislature. So that's the concern. How do we thread that needle? And that's where we're having these discussions on this declining return expectations that you're presenting with our 5% draw rate, with the trailing average, and then we have that alone would be problematic.
Yeah.
And then you add the extra layer of the political environment of ad hoc draws at significant levels, when we're seeing projections yesterday that would take the ERA to zero. And we haven't had the opportunity yet, and I mentioned to the CEO of the permanent fund that's sitting here in the audience that we'll probably be having her back to talk about that. But, we're going to be asking the permanent fund to help feed data to Ledge Finance so we can get a better feel for the impacts of the earnings reserve because of their illiquid holdings that you had mentioned earlier in the permanent fund, where if there's a liquidity draw, they've got to go to their liquid assets. They don't have their entire portfolio to draw from. And then they have the unrealized gains. So we're very concerned that we could put forth a falling domino this year, that it's going to be very hard to stop over the next couple of years and put us in a position that's going to be intolerable for the entire state, not only the permanent fund, but everybody in the whole dang place. So that's the point of the question.
I mean, if you increase the draw above that formula, it strains the ERA. If you went to a POMV model and you increase the draw above the formula, you don't have to worry about the ERA anymore, but you do have to worry about the long-term sustainability of the fund. And you also have to worry, as you pointed out, that if you went to permanent fund staff and said, I need $15 million this year, or $15 billion, I should say, it's got to come out of either the public fixed income portfolio or the public equity portfolio. And now all of a sudden you've sort of inadvertently increased the private markets percentage relative to the public markets, by 15%, right? So that makes it even more illiquid next year if you want to do a similar thing, and then eventually you run out of liquidity entirely. So that if you were to increase the draw to three times what it is, just as a crazy example, it would clearly be unsustainable, and it would result in a riskier and riskier and more illiquid portfolio over time, which, is a death spiral.
Okay, well, as crazy as that may sound, a couple of years ago, a handful of years ago, one political group had a proposal for $10 billion draw. Next year, the other political group had a proposal for a $10 billion draw. And there's only two political groups, without naming anybody's name. So it's a real deal. Okay. And then we fast forward to today, and we have appropriations on the desk, again, that are significantly higher than the draw rate. And there's no increase in our financial flexibility that the committee has been able to find going forward. Things just get worse. So that's the concern.
Well, I think this is probably an analogy you may have heard, but I liken the permanent fund and every sovereign wealth fund to, a forest or a fishery, right? there's only so much it can give before you start to destroy its ability to give it all. And I would suggest that if you can manage this as a sustainable resource, which I think the current formula represents, it can last in perpetuity, but, if you rate it now, it you won't have it later, and you'll have nothing else to fall back on.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you finding that the permanent fund, or I guess are your suggestions that the permanent fund corporation get more aggressive or less aggressive as a result of government spending demands?
I would credit the permanent fund board and the permanent fund staff for not resisting that the urge to become more aggressive simply because of the bigger draw. I think to the credit of the legislature or whoever came up with the current formula, it is sustainable, and I don't think it puts undue pressure on the permanent fund investment staff to take too much risk. There are constant careful conversations. There have been board members who've pushed for more risk. There's been board members that have pushed for less risk. But I haven't seen a change in the basic risk posture of the permanent fund as a result of switching to this sort of POMV draw. I think that there's more focus on liquidity management than there used to be because, again, you have to come up with a lot more cash, and that has to come from somewhere. But that's really the only major investment change that I've seen is just the need to be more thoughtful about how you're going to fund the draw. But again, at the current level, it does seem sustainable. And we haven't seen the permanent fund reaching for additional risk. I think they've been prudent in the amount of risk that they've taken. It's been a slow, methodical, well-forecasted path to taking on a little bit more illiquidity risk in the form of private equity and private debt and infrastructure over time.
Okay, so we got about a little less than 25 minutes. I want you to jump forward to page 26, or you can start on 25 and tell us what you're going to talk about. Because I want to cover some of this stuff dealing with our retirement fund before we run out of time and let you boys off the hook. And then we can come back to page 21 if we have time. And then if committee members have questions when they look through these slides, we can always get them to the appropriate group through the permanent fund to get answers. But I'd really like to have some time on PERS and TERS.
All right. I'm going to turn it over to Steve Center, who's a lead consultant on both of these accounts, and he's the guy that's in charge of talking about performance every quarter, so he's much better at this than me.
Great. So thank you, Greg, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe you said slide 26. Is that correct? So slide 26, this is a little glimpse into the future for the Alaska Retirement Management Board. They are going to be covering this same material at their upcoming meeting later this month. But this is the same projection model that we use for the permanent fund we apply to the Alaska Retirement Management Board, and in particular PERS and the PERS Public Retirement Plan and the Teachers Retirement Plan. Given the asset allocation that both of those plans currently have, we are projecting a median annualized 10-year return of 6.15%, which is 65 basis points lower than the projection that we had last year, given the same asset allocation. As Greg mentioned, we have lowered the inflation expectation, so this uses the same assumptions that the permanent fund does. The projected median 10-year annualized real return as a result has come down 40 basis points to about 4.15%. And standard deviation doesn't really change from where we've seen it in our last projection, coming in at about 13.5%. So compared to the permanent fund, it's pretty much the same risk level, but a slightly lower return. And that really comes from the lower allocation to private assets. So what you'll see for the PERS and TERS plan, a allocation to public securities that's closer to 65%-ish, 70%, and private investments closer to 30%.
Okay, so on this slide, I'd like you to, I don't know if you do it, I forgot to put it to another group, but the ARM board, but I'm going to want to see a bugle graph on this also, going forward, projected return in dollars, and then the standard deviation graph helps the some of the members that aren't as familiar with that type of stuff in the building than others?
Sure. So we, in our exhibits today, we did not bring any risk charts, so our apologies. But I can tell you from the fact that I have to review this with the board every quarter, that the PERS plan historically has had a risk level that's slightly below median compared to other public funds. Mind you, that is realized risk, so not forward projected risk, but it actually has a slightly lower risk than our average large public fund in our Intalent's comparative database.
Right, and then on the Bugle chart in dollars, it gives the committee a graphical representation of the risk going forward of meeting dollar performance of the of the portfolio. And I know you guys have done this many times over the years as I've requested it, well over a decade ago, I think the first time. I can't even remember when the first time was, but somewhere back in there.
We can absolutely pull those charts together,
yeah,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, you've got the model all set up, I know. So if you could do that for me, I think that would be beneficial. We are concerned, naturally, when we look at this portfolio. We've had a conversation here several weeks ago, and we're looking at payments for our unfunded liability that stretch out to the end of the century. Mm-hmm. And we all got a little chuckle on that till there's somebody made a comment that the last beneficiary of the Civil War just passed away a couple years ago. So we're going to have this with us a long time. And we've had historical challenges for various reasons on hitting our dollar target on our portfolio over time, and that's led to increased contributions. So we want to try to keep an eye on that because these contributions have increased and have put significant pressure on our operating budget as our other demands were in place. And as we've had reductions in our agencies, we've had increases in this pension obligation. So we haven't been able to move forward on our structural deficit lately. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a huge difference, but I'm just curious. It looks like a 5 basis point less return than the permanent fund and yet a slight increase in the standard deviation. I'm just curious about that.
That's entirely because of the higher allocation to public equities versus the permanent fund. So the lower allocation to private investments and the higher allocation to public equities results in a slightly higher risk, a little more volatility over time. And that's simply because public equities are valued on a daily basis and will have a higher realized volatility than you would get from private equity. Does that answer your question?
It does. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
We have other questions on slide 26. I think after we get, those responses back, then we can, if the committee wants, we can have a conversation with the ARM board folks at some point before we get out of here sometime in hopefully end of April or first part of May. Okay, we'll go on to slide 27.
Great. So slide 27 looks at historical performance for the PERS plan. We've used PERS as for illustrative purposes here. The PERS and TERS plan have, for all intents and purposes, the same asset allocation, a very slight variances over time, and that really just comes from cash flows in and out of the plans. Comparing the performance for the PERS plan versus its target benchmark over trailing periods, PERS has done fairly well. Ahead of the benchmark over the last 3, 5, 10, and 20 years, really on top of the benchmark over the last 20 years. But this is proof that the underlying investment strategy has performed fairly well relative to its benchmark. North of 10% over the last 5 years, really strong performance.
Okay, if we can just pause here for a second on that, if I can have the committee members just kind of remember that statement, and when we get back in and we start looking at the contribution increases and we see the different changes in the suggested rate of dealing with their unfunded liability, and all the component parts. At some point, we'll probably put that on the table and look at the last actuarial analysis and all the component parts that drive that mechanism. And this is one of the component parts. Go ahead and continue.
Great. Should I go ahead to the next slide?
Yes.
Okay. So looking at 28 and 29, just look at the historical performance of the PERS plan relative to the target index. Really similar to what we saw on the previous chart, but on a cumulative return basis. So just a illustration of how the PERS plan has performed relative to its benchmark. The goal here is for the blue line to be above the green line, and that's exactly what has happened over the last 10 years.
So,
and slide.
Before you go on, so then sorry. I could expect, if we go back to 2011 and we look at the forward projections of the value of the portfolio will then be higher than the projected forward values?
That's a good way to put it. So the target index is reflective of a passive implementation of the target asset allocation. And the blue line represents how well the plan has done in implementing, which will include active management and the alpha that can be generated over time.
So
it is a good, I would say that's a good statement to say that the plan outperformed its likely outperformed the projected return from 10 years ago.
Okay, so we'll wait till we take a look at that, but we'll convert this to dollars because the dollars is the issue at the table.
Mm-hmm. And that I what I could tell you is, you know, the PERS market value as of the end of December was, gosh, about 10.8 billion, I believe. Right. And I do not have the liability numbers in front of me. And I think that's your request for the Bugle chart, putting it in dollar terms would be illustrative and give you a bit more information.
Good exercise. And I think I've had you guys at one point do every year where you gave us the projection, mm-hmm. and every year it advanced forward.
We do have that data.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Senator Wilikowski, and we've got the bells, but we got the guys here for a few more minutes, so we'll take them to the end.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just curious, just briefly, how is the target index selected and has it changed over the last 20 years?
Yes, so the target index does change fairly frequently. This comes from changes in implementation. So let's say the addition of an asset class, for example, or a change in the underlying asset class. So you'll see details here at the bottom of the page that explains the current benchmark makeup. But the benchmark tends to change every physical year, and that comes from, like I said, changes to implementation. So let's say a shift in the allocation between equities and fixed income, or an increase in allocation to private markets, or a change in how things are being implemented. So, for example, within the real estate portfolio within PERS, the real estate portfolio consists of direct investments in farmland and timber and traditional real estate, so office and retail and apartments and things like that. So it's a blend of underlying real estate investments, and that blend can change and has changed over time. So the goal of that benchmark, of that performance benchmark, is to provide a return hurdle for the PERS portfolio that is indicative of the asset allocation for any fiscal year. And that has historically changed over time.
A quick question, then I want to
wrapping up. Very briefly, Mr. Chair. I assume that the PERS total fund return is inclusive of costs and fees when it's compared to the target index?
In this case, it is actually a blend of gross and net of fees. So the private investments are all net of fees. I believe the public investments here are gross. Give me 1 second and I can look that up. I can get you an answer.
Okay. Or you can get back to the committee on that. Yeah. That's not a problem. So we've got a few more minutes left, and I know we got a handful of slides, so I thought it'd be nice if we had Callan pick out of the slides that are remaining, if there's any slide that you feel is that we should take note of or heads up on a couple of slides before we have to go to the floor?
I would recommend looking at slide 21. I know one of the questions that we were sent ahead of time is how the permanent fund is done historically. I'm sure you've all seen this chart. It is one that we include in our materials for the board every quarter. And it's simply a snapshot of historical performance for the permanent fund relative to its benchmarks. Unlike PERS, the permanent fund has a couple different benchmarks that they track themselves against. The first, which we simply call benchmark in this chart, is similar to what we saw for the PERS chart. It is a blended benchmark which reflects the overall asset allocation of the permanent fund. The orange bar is what we call the passive index, and that is simply a blend of publicly traded benchmarks, so equities, bonds, and real estate, and TIPS, which are Treasury inflation-protected securities. This is really an off-the-shelf, what would the return have looked like if the permanent fund had just invested in these passive benchmarks? And then the third benchmark is that return objective of CPI plus 5, which is the grayish olive type color. What I point you to is that the permanent fund over the last 5 years also up 10%. So strong performance, similar to what we've seen from PERS. And over the last 10 years, ahead of all three of those benchmarks with a positive 8.4% return. So as Greg mentioned, the permanent fund team has done a pretty stellar job of implementation. You know, when you're ahead of your benchmark by 70 basis points over 10 years, that's a pretty strong signal of positive implementation. The PERS team does a very good job of staying on top of their asset allocation targets. So their key driver of performance comes from manager selection and alpha generation within asset classes rather than being overweight or underweight in individual asset class. So what this means is that their implementation has been pretty darn strong.
Okay, well, we're going to run out of time. I'd like to thank Greg Allen and Steve Center from Callan Associates and all the years that you guys have helped us here in the state with our assets. It's appreciated. There's good markets and bad markets. We all know that. We just go through them. I'd also like to thank Ms. Angela Riddell, the CEO of the Permanent Fund, particularly with the 10-year performance and her team that has produced those returns. We're very comfortable with the management of the Permanent Fund. Some of us aren't so comfortable with the impact that the legislature might have on the Permanent Fund, but the Permanent Fund itself is doing a good job. But anyway, with that, thank everybody for coming. This will conclude today. Tomorrow, or not tomorrow, you don't have to work Saturdays yet. Monday morning, 9 a.m., we're going to have Senate Bill 19, Extend Special Education Service Agency. That'll be the second reading. If you have any comments, concerns, amendments, bring them to Senator Bishop's office, along with Senate Bill 22, Intensive Game Management. We'll also hold confirmation hearings for the governor's appointees to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees. And with that, thank everybody for coming. We are adjourned.